from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, do you let your elementary school kid walk to school alone? Do you let your 9-year-old play unsupervised at a park? For recent generations of children, play almost always happens in the presence of an adult. But there's growing concern among parents and experts that kids need more freedom to explore the world on their own. We'll discuss how today's parents weigh risks and safety concerns for their kids and what has changed from previous generations. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. In what some characterize as the overprotective and helicopter parent era, it should come as no surprise to learn that today's kids have considerably less freedom than their parents had to take risks and to engage in explorative adventures on their own outside of the home, let alone to walk to school alone or play in a park or playground by themselves. Are today's parents too concerned about their children's safety at the expense of their children turning out to be more frightened and risk-averse and less independent and responsible? I want to take up these and other related questions in this morning's second forum hour, and I want to mention that the catalyst to some of this interest on our part was an article in Slate that was called The Shortening Leash by Jessica Gross and Hannah Rosen, who's appeared on this program. And essentially they were saying limiting risks makes scaredy cats, makes kids less independent and less wild and less reckless, too. But maybe there's just too much monitoring out there. Less freedom? You think so? Well, that's what we're doing to take up in this hour. And joining us here in studio is Rona Renner. She is a parenting coach and author of a book called Is That Me Yelling? Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Gaver Tully with us. He's the founder of the Tinkering School and co-author of a book called 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we want to welcome from Wellesley College, Markella Rutherford, who's associate professor of sociology there and author of a book called Adult Supervision Required, Private Freedom and Public Constraints for Parents and Children. Welcome, Professor Rutherford. Good to have you.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Well, let me begin with you. I want to get kind of an overview and a sociologist's view of this. Reading the Slate article and reading about what we're going to be talking about in The Atlantic, there's been a lot of coverage on it. It talked about panic beginning to take hold during the Reagan era. There were, as many people remember, a few child abductions, and there was a National Missing Children's Day. There were milk cartons, all of those kinds of things. And it increased a sense of panic in parents that is way out of proportion to what the statistics tell us, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And my own research very much backs up what Jessica Gross and Hannah Rosen have found in their survey, that parents are telling – it's not just that parents are remembering the past differently. They really are acting differently toward their children. And this shift really began in the 1980s, where it's very noticeable in the advice that parents are being given and the way that children are talked about in that advice and what they're expected to be capable of, what kinds of movement in public are normalized. And we begin to see in the 1980s that parents begin to be told never to let their children out of their sight, to provide constant monitoring. And that free child moving through public that had been present in visible in parenting advice before that disappeared.
There are other factors, though, that have to be weighed into this calculus. I mean, more breakdown of families, more divorce, more single parents, and really middle class having fewer kids. That's means more investment in the resource, I guess, didn't it? Doesn't it?
Sure. It not only means more investment into the resource, it means that parents as a category are a shrinking part of our population. And parenting as an activity becomes very privatized. We lose a sense of it as a very public role that contributes to a public good.
There's also, of course, parents really not being as connected to the community, or the community not, you know, the old idea of it takes a village and all that, the community not being as strong as it has been in the past. But your work has pretty much highlighted the fact that as freedom outside of the home has contracted, freedom inside the home has grown. You're much more emotional freedom inside the home, under the roof.
Absolutely, because at the same time that we see children's freedom in public being curtailed, there are these new ways that we think about children's autonomy, newer ways that tend to express, that tend to emphasize a lot more private expression of freedom. Families tend to be much more egalitarian. They're less authoritarian than in previous generations. And children, especially middle-class children, are strongly encouraged to express themselves, to share their thoughts and their feelings in ways that previous generations of parents might have found cheeky or intolerable. These kinds of self-expression might have been found disrespectful in the past, but today, middle-class parents especially engage those as a means to build children's self-confidence and self-worth, to contribute to their children's emotional competence.
Well, that's why the one thing perhaps that has not changed in a different direction. I mean, Slate has these statistics. 1971, 80% of third graders walked to school alone. By 1990, it was down to 9%. But all those things changing, going out to play in a playground, kid by himself or herself, all those things. The only thing that goes the other way is going out on dating and premarital sex. Maybe that comes about from what you just mentioned about more communication or more talking within the home. Wondering also about what you indicated a little bit about class differences. I mean, there's more autonomy for working class children, isn't there still?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Several studies show that in general, working class children have a bit more of that public autonomy, especially in their neighborhoods, than middle class children do. And there are a complex set of reasons for this, ranging from just the logistics of being able to have a parent home or pay for after school care or after school care or child care, all the way to the kind of cultural differences in what parents think it's important for their children to learn.
There are a lot of cultural messages. I mean, a lot of those cultural messages come down and you can't depend on anyone but yourself and the parent alone.
Absolutely. So this is a very extreme privatization of the responsibility for children. It's being placed solely on the shoulders of parents. We're not sharing it across the community. Of course, parents have always been mainly responsible for ensuring their children's well-being. But now they are feeling more and more that they are solely responsible.
And again, Markella Rutherford with us by phone is Associate Professor of Sociology at Wellesley's College, and her book is Adult Supervision Required, Private Freedom and Public Constraints for Parents and Children. Rona Renner's here in studio with us, and she's a parenting coach, author of Is That Me Yelling? And has a daughter going off to India. I mean, there are real things to be fearful about in terms of being overly protective.
Well, Michael, it's such a complex subject, and I come to this as a mother, as a grandmother, as a parenting temperament specialist, as a nurse, and my mind has just been going since yesterday thinking about all of this. And I just want to start by thanking Markella to lay it out and talk about the privatization of parenting. I was escorted up here today by a lovely gentleman, and I asked him his experience. I told him what the show was about. And he said to me, you know, when I was growing up, we came home when the streetlights went on. But I knew that Mrs. Johnson was also watching out for me. And if I was going to get into trouble, she was going to tell my mother. And I knew that I had that village, whereas my own children who are, you know, grew up in the Bayview, I kept them in a lot because I was afraid for them. So this subject brings up issues of class, of what class you're in. Can you actually live in a safe neighborhood? It brings up issues of media. And I feel a lot of compassion for parents as they try and make these decisions. In raising four children, I struggled with this on a regular basis. And I still do, since my daughter, Karina, who's 26 today, is going off on
a
trip.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Karina. Karina, you know, I have to breathe a lot, calm myself down, and say that a lot of my fears are based on my own experiences. I was raised in a way that I had a lot of freedom and some bad things happened. I also know from all my kids that it's so valuable for them to feel courageous and competent by going and doing Outward Bound, by having experiences where my older daughter went in junior year of high school and she commuted to San Francisco by taking car rides, car shares every day. I let her do that, Michael. And it was like each decision decision is hard, and that's where I feel compassion for parents. We have to make these decisions based on our knowing our kids, their temperament, considering everything that's going on, and breathing so that we're not overreacting to a fear-based society.
Well, I like your emphasis on knowing the individual child. I mean, because children, some children are more impulsive, some children
that's
have ADHD,
right.
All these kinds of things have to be factored in. But I was reading an article, in The Economist, and this is across the pond, you know, it's published in England, though it's an American publisher as well. Middle-class parents, they're talking in the wide, most broad sense of middle-class parents should give their children more freedom. They say that categorically. Yeah. Would you agree?
I mean, I do think that children need more freedom. It's the way they learn to solve problems. It's the way they learn social skills. We have so little downtime for kids. So much is structured. But yet, it's up to each of us as a parent to really grapple with, is this safe? And what are the risks and benefits? But, you know, when we look at the world we live in, think about climate change. I think about that a lot. And I think that we have to raise children to be stewards of the Earth if we're going to make it into the next century, where children might have to learn how to do things that our kids have never had to do.
But we live in a scary world, and the Slate article, by the way, which is up on our website, if you want to read it, you can just go to kqed.org. It set this whole debate off, and I mean, in terms of the forum staff thinking this would be a good topic for us to tackle. But you talk to these baby boomers, and they did, the two authors of co-authors of the article, and they say, you know, if I found out my kid was doing the things that I did as a kid, I would freak out and I would make my home into a prison.
That's right. I think that's great. I mean, it's really, someone posted on Facebook, I used to walk to school in kindergarten and I would never let my child, I will never let my guard down. What's that about, Michael? We're so afraid.
It's about fear, and it's about the world we live in, unfortunately. It's all too charged. But the fear of going into public places, I mean, has changed a lot of things. You go to playgrounds now, and they're closed off. You can't get in unless you're a parent. I mean, the whole world has changed. And
that's
the Internet
right.
has made it change even more.
But crime is down, Michael. That's the thing that's really interesting. Violent crime is down. Child abduction is down. And yet we're stuck in that fear base. And I think we have to all reflect on that and really decide, where is this fear coming from and is it realistic and can I just stretch a little bit so my children have some sense of wonder and accomplishment and connection?
Well, I want to give out a statistic here. You can look this up. David Finkelhor of Crimes Against Children, the research center, says the abduction of a child by a stranger is no more likely now than it was in the 1970s. There are certainly abductions, but they often have to do with divorce cases and parents fighting over custody and that sort of thing. Let's bring Gabriel Tully into this. He's the founder of the Tinkering School and co-author of 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do. And well, some of those things, you know, some of you may be thinking, with partial supervision, just to give you an idea, you know, drive a nail, play with a pocket knife, throw things from a moving car, lick a battery. these are all things that involve, well, some degree of risk, obviously.
Well, the book itself is as much a book for children as it is for those nervous adults that you're talking about. I mean, what we're really looking at here is a couple of generations of parents who have been raised in fear-based households, and it's no more reasonable to expect someone who never had freedom themselves or unsupervised playtime to expect them to let their kids play is almost impossible. They have no personal culture of that experience and the value of it, so they don't prioritize that. And what's really hard to explain to a parent who grew up in a very closely supervised household is what the long-term benefit of free play for children is and what the value of getting the opportunity to learn how to recognize and mitigate risk on your own. Those kids that you mentioned who are walking to school, you know, that generation that grew up walking to school, those kids who are using public transit in our urban centers, they all have a much better read on who is a dangerous person and who isn't than the children who are being ferried to school in cars and dropped off at the door, because they never have that experience of kind of reading someone and getting those social cues that give you that fear, that reasonable fear response.
But you can't always read a predator. I mean,
of course,
you know, not. In fact, these sociopaths are very good at disguising their motives. And you know, when you were a kid, I was reading about you. You kind of ran around in the forest and went on adventures. As long as you got home by lunch or dinner, everything was fine. But that was another era. One could argue, you know, that we're in a much more scary time. And I think many parents feel that we're in a scarier time because we are.
Well, actually, I'm going to go with Rona on this and Lenore Skenazy and all of those people at Columbia who've been studying it, which is that it actually is the least dangerous time in human history, and that we really ought to be enjoying that freedom, and that the way to make the streets and the public spaces safer is to get more families and more children out into those spaces and not locked away in their apartments.
That's the key, is there's no one else outside playing.
Yeah.
And if we don't build communities that have that sense of that safety net, then we really are in trouble. And I think there are things to be afraid of, like pollution and obesity and
ISIS.
You know, environment. And ISIS, there are fears, but they're not the fears that I think keep us restraining our kids.
Well, part of the problem is there's a kind of peer disapproval in this. I mean, parents scold each other. You let your kid climb up that apple tree, or you let him go across the balance beam, or
absolutely,
that sort of thing. And phobias and a lot of misheard stories that really feed parental fears. Let's go back to Michaela Rutherford on this and get your comment.
Well, absolutely, because this is not just individual parents waking up one day and deciding I'm going to be overprotective. This is a matter of social norms. So parents are making decisions about what to allow their children to do, what to encourage, what to say no to, but they are making those choices within social and institutional arrangements that constrain their choices.
Less responsibility and less opportunity will lead to less a child being less responsible. Is that the kind of equation I'm hearing all of you agreeing on? Doesn't necessarily follow, by the way. Kids can be very responsible just on their own.
Yes, because children are different, and you're giving them different experiences. But my daughter, Mara, came up with something called pushing past perceived limitations. You know, can we help children push past perceived limitations? And what's the value of that? You know, what do you get out of that? And I think that's where your school is working to really see how that develops not only courage, but brain development and brain chemistry.
Well, I'd say, you know, we're in a multi-year experiment here with our school, which is right across the street from the KQED offices here. But the question really is, what becomes of a child who is given those opportunities that are unique in our culture now? And what we're seeing is children who've grown up in our school are uniquely able and capable of interacting in our current world. They approach it as opportunity, not as a source of danger, but as a realm of possibilities. And so our kids engage directly with outside experts, and they coordinate and build field trips and things like that, activities that wouldn't be normal or natural in a traditional classroom are seen as learning experience here.
And how far do you go with that advocacy? I have to ask that question because I know you have kids. It's good for kids to drive cars, for example. in a parking lot, give them that sense of command.
Right.
You talk about kids, putting strange stuff in a microphone or throwing rocks.
Makes us nervous, doesn't it, Michael?
Well, not only that, I'm
does.
Thinking, but, you know, you had a kid recently who was, 9 years old and at a firing range and was told taught how to use a Uzi.
And killed
killed the guy who was the instructor. I mean, how far do
we go? So I like to make a distinction between the insult and injury and the catastrophic. And I would say we are diligent on the prevention of the catastrophic. That's our role as adults in this society, is to prevent children from being catastrophically harmed. I think that there is, however, value in the bump and the bruise and the scrape and the cut. Those are lessons that impart tacit knowledge that can't actually be taught. And even the most important part is the child recovering from that cut or the scrape that teaches the child that these are temporary setbacks and they come out of it stronger than ever, because they believe that they will recover from it.
Of course, there are a lot of parents who can't stand to see a scrape or anything even resembling that. Let me remind you that we're talking about a real question of whether kids are too overprotected today, and we have Rona Renner with us, author of Is That Me Yelling? And Gavertelli, who is a co-author of 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do, and Markella Rutherford, whose book is called Adult Supervision Required. You are welcome to join us, by the way. Let me give the toll-free number if you have some thoughts about this or want to join the conversation. We do welcome your involvement in the program. Any questions or comments, our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your phone calls is 866-733-6786. Certainly welcome parents and weighing in on this subject, or for that matter, children weighing in on this subject. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, and you can also let us know your thoughts or your questions by going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, we welcome your tweets as well. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Markella Rutherford, can I get you to talk about the difficulty many people have just in distinguishing between danger and risk? We tend to equate them together, don't we?
Well, I think there's a useful distinction to be made between danger, which is a kind of imminent threat and needs to be dealt with, and risk, which is a possibility that needs to be calculated. And we don't always know how to calculate these risks. We live in this era of incalculable risks. We've talked about climate change. We've talked about terrorism. These are incalculable risks that make us very anxious. And I think that some of what we're seeing is the projection of this anxiety onto something we feel like we can control, our children.
Let me actually read some comments here. Here's some Facebook comments. Listener writes, overprotective. I do my best to be mindful of letting my child be, but society makes it very hard to have confidence in their safety out and about in the world. People in general seem rather checked out. We're very, very busy just trying to keep up with our own lives. How are we supposed to look out for one another in this fast-paced mode?
Yes.
And another listener says,
absolutely.
Yesterday at a busy intersection on Grand Avenue near Lake Merritt, I watched a woman say to her little boy, take my hand. He did, and they crossed at a red light. Let me read one more Facebook comment. A listener writes, I definitely hold my child's hand when crossing the street. She's not the best judge of risk at 6 years old. If she were more mature, I'd definitely give her more freedoms. Then again, there are adults with little common sense that should have their hands held while crossing the street since they can't be bothered to look up from their phone. I think kids living in cities are more overprotected than their peers in the suburbs early on in life, and I don't see anything wrong with it. Over time, I think the freedom city kids earn will hopefully make them more independent than their suburban peers. Rona's almost bursting here.
Well, Michael, I think this is so key what you just read. Do we take the time to teach our kids what they need to learn? That's the question I have.
Or when do other people take the time to look out for our kids?
That's right, but also
exactly.
when I'm with my grandson and I'm teaching him how to cross the street at 6, I wait, I stop, I ask him to look both ways, I take my time, I want him to learn these skills. Do we take a child and teach them how to build a fire? Thank God I married my husband Mick, because he was so much braver than I was. He taught the kids how to light fireworks, how to use real tools.
How to light fireworks or fires?
Firecrackers. Fires, no, too. No. Fires, too. How to use real tools. He took the time, and I think we all have to question that. Do we take the time needed?
Yeah. And I think there's a great litmus test that we can all ask ourselves, which is, at what age would we give our child a pocket knife? You know, and when you look at that as a litmus test, you find great differences in rural populations and in world populations.
I had a different childhood. I had what they called a stiletto, you know, those knives that came out very quickly. But we're coming up on a break, and when we return, we'll go to your calls and your emails. Feel free to join us. You can go to our website as well and put comments or questions there, kqed.org/forum. Our kids today overprotected, talking with Rona Rennert, with Gaver Tully, and with Markella Rutherford from Wellesley. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Do you let your elementary school kid walk to school alone? Do you let your 9-year-old play unsupervised at a park? For recent generations of children, play almost always happens in the presence of an adult, but there is growing concern about parents and experts that kids need more freedom to explore the world on their own. We're discussing how today's parents weigh risks and safety concerns for their children and what has changed from previous generations. Markella Rutherford is with us from Wellesley. She's Associate Professor of Sociology there and author of Adult Supervision Required, Private Freedom and Public Constraints for Parents and Children. And Gabriel Tully here in studio with us is founder of The Tinkering School, co-author of 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do, and Rona Renner, who's also with us in studio this morning, is a parenting coach and author of Is That Me Yelling? And just another fact here about children abductions that I thought was relevant. This is actually Harvard Kennedy School's Hillary Levy Friedman, who says the chances of a child being abducted by a stranger are comparable to being struck 10 times by lightning. And yet, we've been talking about a decrease in crime and all that. Here's a listener who says, surely the reason there is now less violent crime against children is that parents are more vigilant. Can I go to you on that, Professor?
That's an interesting way to think about it. And I'm not sure that it's always fair to say that the reason that the crimes are down is because we're watching our children so much more closely. In fact, I think that there may be some way that we feel like our children are safer when we're watching them this closely. But we're talking about these kinds of pretty slight risks of harm that would come from other people, and they're incalculable to us in some ways. Now, certainly there are real differences in parents and children's experiences. Some neighborhoods are dangerous, and absolutely parents need to use good judgment about their child and their surroundings and trust their instincts when they feel that something is not safe. But I think that we also need to be letting parents trust their instincts about what is safe. And I don't think we're doing a very good job of supporting that. So parents are feeling like other people are looking over their shoulder. They're being judged. You know, at best, they're being judged by their neighbors and people around them. At worst, they're afraid that they're going to be held criminally negligent if they allow their child to do something that someone else thinks is not safe.
Well, here's a listener who writes on Facebook, I wonder what effect the new mobility of families plays in the loss of child freedom. My parents grew up in a community surrounded by friends and family. Today, so many families move away to live among strangers. And another listener says, I encourage my 6-year-old and my 10-year-old to go out and explore, teaching them how to do that safely, teaching them what a black widow is, teaching them not to talk to strangers, things like that. I think that within reason, it's possible to raise a safe child and still give them freedoms that give them a sense of adventure. A life of overprotection is a life that is not well lived. There's too much out there to experience. And let me go to you on this, Gabriel Tully, and then we'll go to our callers. A Twitter comment from a listener says, yes, parents see child abduction coverage in media and are overreacting. I'm afraid kids not allowed enough free time for free play.
That's right. I think that, and Markella can speak to this too, the natural human behavior is to hear a terrible tragedy and project it into our own lives. And so when we hear about airplane crashes or terrorist activity or child abductions, all relatively rare occurrences, we have a very high empathetic response to it. And so we immediately think that that's going to happen to the child in our lives. And that is an irrational response. It has no relationship to the actual risk, but it is a natural human response. I think it is really important to fight that response and allow your children freedom enough to explore the world on their own terms to the degree that you can be comfortable with.
Well, I remember when many of my listeners, will perhaps remember this. Kevin Collins was essentially abducted, a young boy, from the streets of San Francisco a number of years ago and disappeared and was never heard from again. And, you know, he had been going to school, going to get a bus to take to school and so forth on his own.
Yeah.
I remember so many parents identified with that. Like, if that could happen to this one kid, that could happen to our kid.
So, yeah.
Rona, you were going to say.
Yeah, and I think Markella was going to say something also. I was just going to add that in 2010, 895 children ages 5 to 14 were killed in car crashes.
You know, and I was going to add.
Oh. Go ahead, Markella.
I was going to add that statistically, crimes against children are much more likely to happen in their homes than outside their homes because they're more likely to be harmed by family members and friends than they are by strangers.
Well, people don't think, as I think Avery was suggesting, in statistical terms. It's just like, you know, somebody drives to the airport, they're more likely to get in an accident than they are on the airplane. But they don't think that way. They think, oh, I'm flying and I'm, you know, I'm helpless when I'm flying as opposed to I'm at the wheel. Let me get our callers involved in this, though, and we'll begin with Rye. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I never called into the show, but this topic, it rings really true to me. I'm a general contractor in the Bay Area. I have two young boys, ages 3 and 6, and I adamantly take them to my job site once a month and let them get experiences with power tools and just being on construction sites, because that's how I was raised.
And that scares the hell out of a lot of parents. just the idea of power tools, right?
And I fully encourage that behavior. I think it's really important that parents share both their knowledge, experience, and their excitement for their jobs with their kids.
Well, how old were they when you started, Rye? Just the boy.
I started taking my oldest was 3 years old. I started taking them around the job site just to get the experience so they learn how to walk safely and just be on a job site.
And this is someone who's paying attention. That's what I think is so important here. You're doing it with a lot of awareness and consciousness, and you're careful. You love your boys. And so you're not putting them at risk, but you're teaching them. And I just really think that's great.
Rye, we thank you for the call. We're going to go to another caller, and we'll get as many of you on as we can here. We'll go next to Ann. Good morning.
I want to say I am completely on board with some of the perspective here. I mean, especially with the tinkering school perspective. I mean, my kid uses power tools and so forth. However, I want to ask our guest to please take this out of the judgmentalism about parents arena, because I think that's a really myopic view. I think we've had really huge disruptions in the world in the last 100 years. In the entire expanse of humanity prior to that, most children were not expected to survive into childhood. And now we expect not only for every child to survive, but for every child to thrive. And it's not only a different standard, but we're in a world where everything is changing very quickly. And the amount of things that parents have to know in order to not do boneheaded things that get their children killed, put the car seat in the front, back facing, and so on, not touch things, electrical outlets with wet hands, and on and on and on. It's a long and growing list, and the reaction is, in my opinion, a natural and healthy adaptation to develop a kind of instinctive caution to assess things because everything could be new. And the answer is not to judge parents. It's what you're doing is struggling with figuring out how to create freedom for them. But we need to kind of take the judgmentalism out of it and figure out how we create an understanding of how you take advantage of opportunities in this new world to counter that, not judging people for what is really, I think, a healthy adaptation.
Well, I think there's a lot of nodding in agreement here in the studio, but I wonder how you or the guests would respond to a listener. Sent a Facebook comment. I definitely agree it's better to allow children to roam freely. Unfortunately, it's not always that easy. A number of parents recently in the news have been arrested for allowing their children exactly this kind of freedom. How do we allow our children to have freedom when it's practically illegal in the country to do so?
Well, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Lenore Scanese does a really good job of highlighting these in her Free Range Children blog, but she's been cataloging all of these arrests and showing how the arrest is completely unfounded and actually illegal. It is completely legal to allow your children to play in the front yard unsupervised. It's completely legal to leave your child at a park.
A lot of these police were brought up by overprotective parents, so they don't necessarily...
Exactly, and this is an example, I think, directly to the previous speaker about parents are judged so harshly in our society for every little experiment they do, for everything they try. I think it is really important to support parents and see it as a growth opportunity, not as an opportunity to judge someone because they did it differently than you would do.
I think also there was a race issue, too. I just want to say that, the mother who was arrested because she left her child at the park was arrested in part, I believe, based on the fact that she was a black mom. And I think if Lenore wasn't arrested, who let her child go on the subway alone, my daughter in Boulder is not going to be arrested when she lets her son walk partway to school by himself. So it's a complicated issue, and I just appreciate the caller talking about reducing judgment. And I think I'm not trying to judge parents at all. I'm saying it's up to us to know our kids, but know all the influences that are affecting us.
Markella Rutherford, you wanted in here, yeah?
Well, it's not only not fair to blame parents, it won't do any good.
It's not an individual problem. Right. It's a social kind of problem. So we can tell parents all we want, let your kids walk to school. But if we aren't collectively planning our communities so that they're walkable,
right.
And let me go
what
to,
do we expect them to do?
Actually, yeah. Looking at a website comment here that I'd like to go to you on, Markella Rutherford. A listener writes, your guests are overlooking an important dynamic that affects the data, computers. That's keeping this generation indoors today, at least as much as helicopter parenting, and would be expected to be a stronger trend with higher incomes, which explains the middle class, working class difference. I have a white collar career and everyone in the family has his own computer. That trend needs to be controlled for before drawing additional conclusions.
I don't buy it.
Yeah.
I don't buy it. I think, yeah, they're spending more time on computers because they're cooped up inside.
Okay. I agree.
Kids have always had some form of media they could use. You know, before computers, it was television. Before that, it was comic books.
We'll bring in more of your calls.
That kids weren't playing outside.
Yeah. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air with us.
Great. Thanks. First of all, you guys, this is a great topic. I'm glad you're covering it, Michael. The show is terrific. More stuff for parents and kids in the future. You talk about that last comment specifically speaks to something that's near and dear to my heart and that helps kids break through and blast through. I made a movie about it called Beaverbrook, which is that summer camp is a great place for kids to go who can afford it. Unfortunately, it's very expensive. And they are away from the parents. They are away from the teachers. They are away from the soccer practice. They are away from everything. They are surrounded by a bunch of young, inexperienced mistake makers as counselors, and that is fantastic for kids because they also get a social experience. Most summer camps, except for the computer camps, and I think calling those camps is ridiculous, but summer camps give kids a wonderful opportunity to socially interact with each other without the iPhones and the iPads and the computers and everything else that goes along with it. They get to live and work in a community with other kids and in their own age group and with surrounded by other age groups as well. There's a lot of opportunity for kids to get and see examples of good behavior, of bad behavior, and it's a risky environment in a lot of ways, especially camps that offer things like horseback riding. And a lot of the camps now today have activities where kids can get hauled up into a tree and let go on a harness.
Matt, you're a one-man campaigner for summer camps.
But what about kids who can't afford it? What about the kids who can't afford it?
There are big class differences, though, as you implied and as you suggested. But I'm all for summer camps if people can afford them. Thank you. We'll get another caller on. That's you, Lane. Thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I grew up in the suburbs, Southern California in the 1970s, and now I've been living in the city. My wife and I are just being very cautious and struggling a little bit to raise, we have a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old, and to be able to allow them the freedom, some freedom, in this kind of really densely urban environment. And we're coming up against, younger families, who they have kids the same age, but, they've been more restrictive. And, we want to be careful and educated about it, but we let our child walk to school as soon as she was able to, leave, illegally the school. We started letting her have that freedom and, she has a Clipper card for the bus, and we've just found that she's allowed to do these other things that a lot of the other parents are still not willing to quite let their kids do.
Well, Lane, thank you. Good to hear from you on your own personal experience there. And in fact, I want to go to another caller because a lot of this breaks down between urban and rural, just like there are class breakdowns. And this is Gwen, who grew up in the 50s, walked to school, and now a very different world from your perspective, Gwen, huh?
Yes, I walked through a graveyard. My parents took me to school once in kindergarten in Cecilia. But I grew up in a different era. Like in Oakland, you know, you're playing out in your front yard and you're liable to get shot. And about 2 years ago in Mountain View, there was this girl walking to school and she got kidnapped. And that's been in the news lately. So I just think the people that are on this show are they're white, middle class, and they're in the clouds in academia, and they aren't living in a real world, or at least today's real world.
Gwen, thank you for that call. I want to dovetail your remarks and get the participants here to respond to your remarks, but along with another remark from a listener who writes, who is this program directed towards? This week, a 14-year-old out with his family at 7 p.m. in San Francisco was stabbed to death by another kid. This terribly sad event happened to families living exactly the way your guest suggests. We live in a horribly violent and armed society.
You know, I really appreciate, Gwen, what you said. I worked in Richmond for 14 years in the Iron Triangle, and I have to say that I fully agreed with the parents who did not let their kids walk to school alone, play outside alone. That's where it is, know your child, know yourself, know your environment, and weigh the risks and benefit. And I think that's where our society is so wrong and is so skewed, because we have, you know, kids who are privileged who can go to camp and other kids who can't and can't play outside. You touched on it, and I think that I'm sorry if it sounded different, but you're absolutely right. We have to know our own environment and trust our own instincts, but consider it thoughtfully.
Here's a tweet from a listener who says, number of parents solely responsible today for their children's well-being? Well, no villages anymore. And kind of dovetailing with that, on our Facebook page, one of our listeners writes, it's less about parenting philosophies and more about community habits. All the latchkey kids I hear of from 60s and 70s have had a good, solid community surrounding them. It's easy to ride on parents making them feel guilty of overprotecting their kids, but where is the community that allows for more freedom? Oh, wait, it exists on Facebook. Let me get another caller in here. And Christian from Napa, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually a retired security executive, and I'm raising two children, girls, 10 and 15. And what, you know, I think the panel is hitting on is the actual ability of parents to do, you know, the kind of technical risk analysis of a situation that they live in and where they're at and what the lifestyle of the child actually is. And they can't learn that if they're surrounded constantly by these, well, particularly here in Napa, it's a very, we have kind of a stratified group, but we have an upper middle class group of helicopter moms that, you know, drive their kids to school until they're 18. How are the children supposed to learn how to judge risk if they're never given those opportunities?
You're raising a key question, and let me go to you again, Gabe Vertelli, on this. By the way, Gabe Vertelli is also founder of Brightworks, which is a K-12 school in San Francisco.
Well, I think your caller touches on a really important thing, which is that if we start taking away opportunities to learn how to recognize and mitigate risk, children develop no intuitive sense of how dangerous an activity is. We see this all the time with kids who have never gotten to work with fire. When they first approach fire, they're much more likely to get burned, whereas kids who've grown up around fireplaces and fires have a way of approaching fire which is very incremental, where they test to see how hot this fire is. Is this something I can add something to? That approach to risk of small experiments and learning from those small experiences is very different than what we see with kids who are raised in very protective situations where they don't see a gradation of risk. What they see is finally an opportunity to try something, and they immediately injure themselves. And that is the learned difference of a childhood that embraces opportunity for children to approach danger, to approach risk.
I've been talking mostly about younger children, but I'm looking at an email here. It's an interesting question. I'll just put it out there. would you let your 16 and 15-year-olds bungee jump on a family vacation?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I could just step in on that, those are packaged adrenaline experiences that are, depending on the circumstance, either very safe or very risky. But if you look at the number of people that go through that operation, you can see that all of those situations are designed to trigger that fear response and then have you survive. I think a much more interesting question comes back around to the simple things we can do in families, which is, when do you start your child on a bicycle? When do you give them a pocket knife? When do you let them play with fire in the backyard or in the hibachi? These are all things that you can do in almost any situation.
90.
But we don't seem to create opportunities for that. And those are small steps we can take together.
Well, apropos, again, of that, here's a comment from one of our listeners. As a parent and teacher, it seems to me that what we need is not a return to previous generations' approaches to allowing children freedom. We cannot mourn the way things used to be. We need a new way of allowing our children to explore and take risks. I would like to see parents, schools, and community leaders working together to create adventure parks and neighborhood parent watch groups. As parents and educators, we must reach out to each other to create environments that give children space to grow and take risks. A thoughtful remark, and I think a remark right on the money, so to speak.
Yep.
We need these new, I suppose, and more inventive challenges, and that's a challenge in itself, Markella Rutherford, isn't it?
It is. I'd kind of like to go back to what the previous caller, I believe it was Gwen, was mentioning about some of the vast differences in experiences between different social classes, different neighborhoods. Again, I want to really emphasize this is not about blaming parents won't help. We have to accept it as a social situation that requires a social response. We have to create safe neighborhoods where neighborhoods are not safe, at the same time that we have to have a kind of cultural norm shift that supports parents letting their kids experiment with fire under supervision. And these are both part of the same cultural approach to thinking about children as our collective responsibility.
And I remind you, you are
the individual responsibility of parents.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Markella Rutherford of Wellesley College. Gebra Tully is also with us, founder of Brightness Works, a K-12 school here in San Francisco, and Rona Renner, who's a parenting coach. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll go to another caller, and that's Jasmine. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say a couple things. One is I grew up in Oakland in the 70s and 80s. I was expected to walk to school every day, and I think it was actually a lot more dangerous in the 80s than it is now with all the little gentrified pockets that are popping up here and there and everywhere. Also, I have a 22-month-old, and I already allow her to do things that I see my friends with children who are much older. My cousins have a 5- and 8-year-old who've never even been around fire before. They're not allowed to walk to school, and they live, in a very expensive neighborhood in Orange County. Their parents told me they don't even trust their kids to be able to walk to school. I take my daughter camping. You know, she's played with fire. She helps me in the kitchen every day with cooking. She's helped my husband build our patio in the backyard. And we don't want to feel that she's incapable because we're creating those incapabilities of our own fears. And when we lived down in South America as Peace Corps volunteers, I saw kids walking around with machetes and knives, and it was because they watched how you were supposed to do those things carefully that when I became a parent myself, I realized, I just have to be careful about how I monitor what she does and allow her to experience things so that she knows fire is hot, knives can cut you. I think it's really good for her.
Okay, thank you. Rona Renner.
Michael, I lived in Africa for a while with two small children, and we were in the Congo, and it was really an eye-opener for me to see how older children were taking care of younger children, and they were playing in the dirt, and they were doing things that really helped me understand that our children did need to be closer to the earth. They needed to be caring for each other, and I think, again, it goes back to the due diligence and the awareness. And, one of the reasons I wrote Is That Me Yelling was to try and bring mindfulness into parenting around yelling, but it's about everything. Can I have my little, 2-year-old helping me if I'm paying attention and I'm not on my cell phone instead?
I'd also, because we did a program yesterday on dangers of the internet and so forth. If parents want to be monitoring of their children, they should particularly watch them in terms of the dangers of online predators and that sort of thing. Here's a listener who writes, I grew up in South Manhattan long ago. The neighborhood was ethnically and
religiously diverse. The kids were mostly working class, Irish and Italian. We were lower middle class German Protestants, so I had plenty of fights and ran away from many too. But those kids did not carry weapons or steal. In retrospect, I'd say that having to worry about street fights every time I left home, which was a constant concern between age 7 and 12, made me better able to relate to people of different backgrounds as well as more able to detect danger. On the other hand, if the kids carry weapons and steel, then the level of violence on the street would be unacceptably high and parents should regrettably keep their kids at home. And here's another listener who says, I grew up as a latchkey kid and honestly, it was not safe nor empowering. I think that experience has made me more cautious with my own kids. But I wonder how the guests suggest I should send my kids out to play when there are no sidewalks and we live in a community that's very car-based. My husband walks to BART. Yeah. It's barely safe for him. Mm-hmm. I think holding individual parents responsible for overprotection when the institutional forces have created communities that put the onus of safety on private families. And, well, go back to our sociology professor.
Exactly.
Yeah, Markella Rutherford.
That's exactly it, that this is something we need to approach more institutionally as a collective issue rather than just shifting it back to individual parents. Individual parents, individual families won't be able to make the kinds of changes that are necessary for parents to feel that it's safe to encourage their kids to have more and more forms of public autonomy.
And final word from Rona and Gaver?
Well, I was just thinking about schools, too. You know, what are we learning in school? We're learning to sit in circle time. We're not letting kids outside play in recess. We're not taking them. My friend Rue Mapp does outdoor afro, trying to help kids go out into nature. So as a structure, as an institution, you know, as a school is, we have to do something different.
Yeah. Gaver, tell
me. I'd like to point at our own school, Brightworks, right across the street here from KQED, as an example of what a school might look like if it wasn't children sitting in a desk, but it was kids engaging with real materials, real tools.
Well, here's a tweet from a listener. It says, get them GPS trackers into their clothes and backpack and let them go out and play and live. Okay. Good place to end here. Thank
Technology
you all.
Technology will save us.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this conversation online by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. I want to thank our great staff, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our online support comes from David Marks. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.